You are listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast out of Wesley Seminary at Iowa. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Assistant Professor of Pastoral Care.
What's the nature of truth? Is there such thing as a unified vision of truth? What are some of the implications of a secularist worldview or a materialist worldview? These are some of the questions underlying the questions that I talk about in this episode with Nancy Piercy. If you're familiar with apologetics, you're familiar with Nancy Piercy. She's been writing for a long time. She's written with Chuck Colson. She's been teaching for a long time at different places, and she's been a visiting scholar at Biola University. She's been a professor at Cairn University. She's worked with the Francis Schaeffer World Journalism Institute. She's currently professor of apologetics and a scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. She's recently written the book Love Thy Body, and we talk about this book in today's podcast. If you are one who's exploring some of the implications of the worldview that's becoming more and more in vogue in today's West, today's episode is for you. Thanks for tuning in. So the book you've recently written is called Love Thy Body. It's published by Baker Press. I want to start with a brief overview and then ask you an introductory question. One thing that the book rides on is this idea that you've discerned that truth has been divided, that we can have some things that are true subjectively, things that are only true for me, and other things that are true objectively or true for everyone. And you argue that this split, sometimes known also as the value or fact distinction or split, you say that it's also been revealed in the distinction between Enlightenment and Romantic philosophies, and eventually, which comes to form so many of the arguments in your book, has created a split between the person and the body, so that the person can be something that is true for someone as an individual, whereas the body might be something that's relegated to objective truth. And you've argued that there's a major distinction, that we often see these two in a majorly distinct way with bad consequences. You go on to show how these kinds of splits have terrible effect in a number of situations, including abortion, hookup culture, transgenderism, and others. So now that we've tried to give kind of a scope of the book, and that's condensing, 300 pages into 45 seconds or so. But now that we have a scope of the book, I'd like you to kind of bring us back to the start. How did you initially discern this split in truth?
That's a good question. Personally, how did I discern it? It's because I became a Christian at LaBrie, which is the ministry of Francis Schaeffer. And Francis Schaeffer wrote about the division of the concept of truth. It was one of his major themes. And he used the metaphor of two stories in a building. So that the lower story is what we know by science, and that's considered objectively true, factual, empirical, something that everyone has to accept regardless of your private beliefs. And then the upper story is the realm of values, meaning, purpose, theological and moral truths. And he tried to explain that this is one reason Christians have a hard time communicating with our secular audience, because when we make a truth claim about theology, we are making an objective truth claim, but the secular person is hearing it as a statement in the upper story, where it's just a personal, private preference.
Yeah, true for them, but not for, maybe true for you, but not for me.
Right, and Christians have been slow to understand that the very concept of truth has changed, so that when you say to somebody that Christianity is true, they're not hearing what you mean. And the way that started was really with the rise of the scientific revolution. Many people began to say, well, the only truly reliable form of knowledge is what we know by science. So that became the lower story. But the trouble is, what happens then to moral truths? Anything that's not empirically knowable, moral truths, theological truths, you can't stuff them in a test tube or study them under a microscope. So many people simply decided they weren't really truths anymore, that you had to relegate them to what Schaeffer called the upper story, meaning they were just private and subjective and personally meaningful maybe to you, but you can't impose them on others, to use the typical modern phrase. So this division, the thing is, if you have a divided concept of truth itself, that is going to end up influencing everything else you think, every other area that you think about. So I, you know, I didn't go into this topic thinking I was going to find the same split. But I started reading thinkers, especially some Catholic thinkers have seen this, John Paul II and Robert George at Princeton. They had seen it in relation to the life issues like abortion and euthanasia, that abortion, in terms of the secular arguments for abortion, they all rest on this a dualism, a division that's like the fact-value split, but now applied to the person, it becomes the body-person dualism. So that bioethicists, professional bioethicists today all agree that life begins at conception. That's not even an issue anymore. The scientific data is just too strong. So what they all say is, okay, yeah, the fetus is human, scientifically, biologically, physiologically, but it's not yet a person with moral worth and worthy of legal protection. And so that's how they get around the finding that, of course, the fetus is human. But they get around that by saying that's not the same thing as a person. So you see the person, the body-person dualism becomes the heart of the secular argument for abortion.
Let me take it back just a little bit. Maybe some listeners are wondering, and like you said, if they're not wondering, they've certainly been asked, well, what's the big deal? What does it matter that a person can determine some truths for themselves and not have them be have implications for others? So what's the big deal about that?
See, this is a total truth theme more than a lovely body theme, so it's not on the tip of my tongue anymore.
Sure.
I think that the deepest issue, let me go back to when I was at LaBrie and I was first facing these issues. I had grown up in a Christian home, a Lutheran home, and when I was in high school, I started asking, how do we know it's true? I went to a public high school, all my friends are secular, all my teachers are secular, and I just started asking, how do we know Christianity is true? And none of the people I talked to could answer that question. My parents, my pastor, there was no apologetics back then. And no one gave me a decent answer. I'll give you just one example. I talked to a Christian professor at a secular university. And I thought, well, he's got to be somebody who's thought through these things. So I said, point blank, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me. I thought, that's it. That's the level of answer I tended to get. I even asked a seminary professor. He was a dean of a seminary. And his only answer was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. And I thought, well, then why don't you have answers to my doubts? So that at that level of the kind of answer I was getting, I decided Christianity must not have any answers. And I very intentionally set it aside. This was about halfway through high school. Because I had been a Christian, though, I realized very quickly what the implications were, that if there was no God, there really was no meaning to life. We were just on a rock flying through empty space, basically. There was no foundation for ethics. There was just what, like you said earlier, what's true for me, what's true for you. There was not even foundation for thinking. For I became a skeptic because I realized that if all I have is my puny brain in the vast scope of time and history, then what makes me think I can know any sort of absolute or universal truth? Ridiculous. It struck me as obviously ridiculous to think I could have any truth. So by the time I arrived at LaBrie a couple of years later when I was in college, I had become a complete relativist skeptic, nihilist practically. I arrived having completely absorbed a secular worldview. And so the first question I had to work through was, is there any truth at all? Schaeffer used to say that we have to do pre-evangelism. That was his word. Some people have to work through a lot of preliminary questions before they're even open to the gospel. And the main one is the question of truth. I was such a relativist by the time I arrived at LaBrie that I had to take two stages. I had to first be convinced that there was such a thing as truth before I could even consider whether Christianity was that truth. That's why the question of truth is so important. because we can't even make decisions about what we cannot intelligently evaluate truth claims if we don't think there's any such thing as truth.
What about the political objection? So somebody is tracking along with you and they're saying, okay, I understand that if there's going to be some kind of meaningful dialogue, then there has to be at least an agreement that there is an answer worth coming to, that there is an answer that we can find out to some of these really difficult questions. But maybe they've got the political objection that goes something like this, that in a free culture, we can't impose our beliefs on other people, and we must respect as much as possible another person's right to self-determination. How might you respond to that?
I think, now, you know, this is in the context of love thy body, so let's relate it to these moral issues. The thing is, we have to help people understand that for free society to be possible, certain rights have to be pre-political. In other words, we have to acknowledge that some realities exist before the state. The state doesn't create them. The state only recognizes them. The classic example is the right to life. You don't have the right to life because the state gives it to you. You have it just because you're a member of the human race. The state has to recognize that. The state doesn't create it. If the state creates it, then the state can take it away. The state can decide some classes of humans are not legal persons worthy of legal protection. Well, that's exactly what's happened with abortion. You know, as we said earlier, secular bioethicists today argue that the fetus is human, but it's not a legal person. And so what they've decided, essentially, they've said, what the Supreme Court essentially said in Roe v. Wade in 1973 is there are certain classes of humans who are not persons. That you can be human and not have human rights. So what that means is none of us. Technically, the implication is none of us anymore has human rights just because we're human.
That rights are a kind of fiction, right? Something that's been written onto us, not something that is inherently within us.
Yes, and more ominously, that it's the state that creates them. And the same thing with marriage. Let's take the homosexual issue, same-sex marriage. Marriage is a pre-political right. States don't create marriage. It's natural. It's a natural reality. Men and women attracted to one another, get together, have babies. It's a biological attraction based on the fact that humans are a sexually reproducing species. But what Obergefell did, the same-sex marriage Supreme Court decision, what they said is, well, wait a minute. Marriage doesn't depend on biology. Marriage is just an emotional connection, which can happen between people of any two sexes. Well, what does that mean, though? We have lots of emotional connections. So the state has arrogated the right, the authority to decide what marriage is, because it's the one that decides which emotional commitments qualify as marriage. So marriage is no longer a pre-political right. Life is not a pre-political right. Marriage is no longer a pre-political right. It's something that the state has taken upon itself the right to decide. And what same-sex advocates next pushed for was parenthood. Parenthood is a pre-political right. The state doesn't decide your kids are your kids. You know, that's based on biology. You and your wife, you know, have a biological relationship to your kids. But for the state to treat same-sex couples the same as opposite-sex couples, the state had to decide biology doesn't matter. That what matters is the emotional connection you have with your kids. And that's what there was a 2017 Supreme Court decision that made that took that step, that said, no, in order to grant parenthood to same-sex couples who, you know, because in any same-sex couple, at least one is not related biologically to the children. So the Supreme Court had to say, well, parenthood is not defined by biology anymore. It is defined by an emotional commitment. And what does that mean? Again, essentially the state decides. So when we talk to people about these issues, we have to help them realize that there are deep political issues at stake where we are losing our pre-political rights, because most of our pre-political rights are based on biology. And when the state So no. Well, let me say one more. Gender. Up until now, people thought your gender depended on your biological sex, that there was really no difference. But what transgender advocates are saying is, no, your biological sex has nothing to do with your gender. And as the state steps in and enacts policies based on that, what it's essentially saying is, okay, your gender does not follow on your biological sex. The state decides, essentially. Now, it relegates the decisions to individuals. Like an abortion, it relegates it to individual women. But in principle, it's the state that decides who gets to decide.
Right.
And so it's ultimately the state arrogating the rights. In all of these issues, by denigrating biology, that's why the book is called Love Thy Body, by denigrating the body and biology, we are losing pre-political rights, and the state is gaining power.
Now, obviously, as we've just come through this conversation, you don't shy away from complex scenarios, right? Tough questions. And one of the things that you bring up is even some tough scenarios that are not always flattering to the church. So you mentioned a couple of stories of people who have been shunned by the church or rejected by the church, and what a travesty and injustice that was. So you're consistently arguing for the church to practice a deep and profound hospitality. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Why is that so important?
Yeah, I think that, let me preface that by saying things are really changing. If you talk to people who grew up, say with same-sex attraction, if you talk to older people, they have a lot of hostility against the church often because they have felt as if they were treated as though sexual sins were the worst sins, and homosexual sins were the worst of the worst. Mm. And that if you attracted the same sex, you would be on the pale. I tell the story of a woman named Rebecca. I have lots of stories in Love Thy Body. By the way, even though we're talking on a fairly theoretical level, the book is full of personal stories. And one of them was Rebecca. And she said, when I realized I was attracted to other women, I felt like I'd broken out with a disease, like leprosy, you know. Surely everyone could see I was now defiled, you know. Mm. There was a sense of deep corruption that had somehow taken over. And so with older people, you have to realize many of them have grown up with a lot of guilt and shame. And I think that we have to, one of the messages that we need to get across is that it's not the worst of the worst. We're all sinners and we're all on the same level. Before the cross, we're all on the same level. What I have to help people realize, though, is that it has really changed recently. And parents and teachers and pastors are not always up on how much it's changed. Now there's incredible pressure on young people to be non-heterosexual, to be non-binary. Let me give you an example. So I interviewed a young college student in Love Thy Body who just graduated in music. And she said, in music, if you're not gay, you're treated like you're a nobody. Mm. And another example is, in a recent study came out on transgender kids. It was by Lisa Littman at Boston University. She interviewed the parents as a preliminary study. And many of the parents said when their kids, this mostly daughters, since it's really taking off among girls right now, when their girls came out as transgender, their popularity increased dramatically.
Hmm. You argue that a deep connection between personal identity and the body, so bringing those together that you see are split apart, but trying to bring those together again, a deep connection between personal identity and the body is essential for women to be valued. What's the connection between valuing the body and valuing women?
This is a good question, and it brings to light a really fascinating development that's happening just recently, that many feminists who are concerned about the transgender movement are starting to link up with Christians. And there's even a group called Hands Across the Aisle, and it's conservative Christian women and radical leftist, many lesbian socialist feminist women. And they're coming together on the trans issue, because the transgender issue is basically saying your body doesn't matter. All that matters is, you know, who you declare yourself to be. And so a lot of male-bodied persons are calling themselves women. And as you know, they're making incursions into women's sports and rape shelters and homeless shelters and locker rooms and bathrooms and so on. And so feminists are concerned about this because they're saying, wait a minute, if you cannot define what a woman is by her biology, I mean, that's sort of the basic objective fact. You know, no matter what your feelings are, your biology, you're either male or female. And, you know, with a small number of intersex people, but intersex people themselves are not claiming to be a third sex. They're rhetorically used that way, but they themselves don't. But if you're either male or female, and that's an objective fact, no matter what your feelings are, if we cannot define women by the objective fact of biological sex, then how can we protect women? How can we have sex-based legal protections if you cannot identify that category of persons? Mm. So feminists are very concerned about the transgender movement because it is basically saying there's no such thing as women. Here's an example. So a friend of mine just emailed me saying my daughter is attending midwifery school. She's going to be a midwife. She was reprimanded for using the word mothers when she talked about nutrients passing from through the placenta from the mother to the baby. And she was reprimanded for saying mother. Why? Because some trans men, that is women who claim to be men who've adopted that identity, you know, can still get pregnant. And so some quote unquote men will be pregnant. And so she was literally threatened with being kicked out of the program if she continued to use the word mother. So that would be an example where the very identity of women is being erased, and the definition of women no longer rests on any objective basis. So how can the law protect a group if you can't define them?
We mentioned this before, and the book it's thoughtful and critical, but it's really readable as well. And I really appreciated your consistent inclusion of stories, especially from your students. It's clear that you've talked to students who are really in the thick of this and have just come out of high schools where they've been wrestling with the implications of some of the worldview that is being presented to them. It seems you've really developed a rapport with these students, and they're willing to speak to you about really personal, even private considerations. I'm wondering, how did you go about developing that rapport? How were you able to do that with your students?
Well, I have to tell you that many of the student stories come out of the fact that I did a lot of reading groups with Love Thy Body when it was still in manuscript form. Hmm. And so that did give us the basis for talking about these issues. But it also is the tone of the manuscript, because I knew people before I even did the reading groups, because I knew people who were struggling with these things. The tone is different from your average book. Let me give you an example. So I have read a few Christian books on transgenderism where it's pretty clear they don't know any transgender people. You can tell there's a lack of personal connection. And in my chapter on transgenderism, I tell the story now he's a young man, but he clearly had gender dysphoria from a very young age. And these people I knew very, very closely. So I watched him grow up, and before he was even walking, his babysitter said to his mother, "He's too good to be a boy," by which she meant, you know, he was gentle, quiet, compliant, the things we stereotypically associate with a girl. Mm. Even in preschool, when his mother picked him up from school, he was invariably playing with the little girls, not the little boys. By elementary school, he was frequently coming to his parents weeping and saying, "I don't fit in anywhere. I think like a girl. I feel the way a girl does. God should have made me a girl." And I was close enough to this family that I was, you know, he was talking to me as well. In fact, they took him through my book, Total Truth. It has a chapter 12, where it talks about the historical changes in the definition of masculinity and femininity so that he wouldn't feel like you must comply with whatever the current definition of masculinity is. But the question is then, what does his parents do? You know, they made sure he knew they loved him just the way he was. I have heard stories from young people who say my parents tried to toughen me up by pushing me into more masculine activities and sports and so on. And they didn't do that. They made sure he knew that it was okay to be a emotional, sensitive, relational boy. You know, that was fine. That God had perhaps was equipping him for one of the caring professions, like counselor or psychologist. And like I said, they told him that definitions of masculinity change. You don't have to fit in. You don't. And they took him through the Bible. I mean, look at the spiritual gifts. They're not divided by sex. You know, preaching and leadership are not said to be masculine. And teaching and prophecy, I guess, to be precise, teaching and prophecy are not said to be masculine. And mercy and service are not said to be feminine, as we might think. Mm-hmm. You know, so they made sure he felt loved and accepted from the beginning. So it's personal experiences like that you almost have to have yourself. Mm-hmm. If you don't know any, seek them out. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't know people who are struggling with same-sex attraction or transgenderism, gender dysphoria, seek them out. It makes all the difference. Here's another example. My chapter on abortion did not quite have that personal tone because I frankly don't know a lot of people who've had abortions. And then I did the reading group with my graduate students, and three women in the course had abortions. And they gave the stories. I tell some of their stories in there, and that changed the tone. Mm-hmm. That changed the tone of the chapter on abortion. Mm. All of a sudden, you see, that's the one area where millennials usually agree with us, right? The young people are right now even more pro-life than their parents' generation. So I felt like I was on pretty common ground there. And then I did this reading group. So that helped a lot. I changed a lot to emphasize more how the church can help women, you know, in crisis pregnancy or minister them after an abortion.
Yeah, that was one of the things that you had pointed out, is we've often got ministries to a variety of people who have gone through difficult pasts or are coming out of making choices that have had really difficult consequences for them. But we don't often have ministries to women who have had abortions. And yet we know from statistics that women who have had abortions often suffer with depression, often have tremendous amounts of guilt and shame, and they want to keep those stories hidden. But we don't often have very overt ministries to women who have suffered who have gone through abortion.
And that was a result of one of my students. One of my students she got pregnant as a result of rape. She was raped on a Christian college campus in her dorm room by a former boyfriend that she had broken up with. And he was angry at her. And that was his revenge. He attacked her. He assaulted her sexually. And what did she do? When she found out she was pregnant, her first thought was, my church will shun my family. Her first thought was, how can I protect my parents? And why did she expect that her church would shun her family? That was her first thought. And she signed up for the first available date that she could get an abortion. And in fact, she even lied about it in class at first. She started the class saying, no, I haven't had an abortion, you know, as she was making some point. And then 2 weeks later, she said, I lied. I have had one. And it was the first time she'd ever admitted it to anyone. So that, you're right. And she's the one who said, the church is more willing to accept a convicted felon, a convicted murderer, than a woman who's had an abortion. And I thought, that sounds a little exaggerated. And then she said, think about it. Think about how many prison ministries there are. How many ministries there are to people in prison who are convicted of other crimes. But how many ministries are there to women who had an abortion? Okay, you're right.
I want to finish our time together by turning in a little bit of a different direction. So about 18 months ago or so, you were featured alongside several other women in a Christianity Today article that discussed the rise of women in apologetics. A couple of questions on this. What unique voice are women bringing to apologetics?
Well, there are a couple of apologetics groups that are particularly oriented towards parents. There's Apologetics for Parents with Natasha Crane. There's Mama Bear Apologetics, which is obvious, towards mothers. So mothers often are more involved. And most women do end up being mothers at some point. So when I say mothers, that's going to be most women. They are more involved with their children, especially in the early years. And so they bring to apologetics, I think, often some of the emotional sensitivity that you develop dealing with young children. You pretty much have to. You develop a greater sensitivity to nonverbal communication because kids are not that verbal. You develop the ability to unpack things more simply. I was talking to a teacher just yesterday, in fact, who said 10 years of being a teacher and talking to young children has really taught me how to be a better apologist. Because, you know, as adults, you often use language that, if you really thought about it, you haven't, you're using words without really thinking through what they mean. If you talk to a young person, especially depending on the age, you have to unpack it in a way that you don't for other people, for other adults. I actually got my writing career started writing for first through third grade. And I was writing these little science publications for a creationist organization. At any rate, and then the next year they needed somebody for four through six. And then I worked my way up to high school and then adult. But it was fascinating because I got to work through each grade level. And I always encourage people who aspire to be writers to write for children because it teaches you how to unpack and simplify. So I think that most, you know, I won't get into the question of whether women or men are inherently, you know, more empathetic or whatever, but certainly the experience of raising and teaching children gives you good communication skills.
What might you say to young women who are sensing a vocation, a scholarship vocation, and maybe even specifically apologetics? What might you say to these women who are thinking about heading into this field?
Well, first of all, go for it. I think it's great. And I do get a lot of people asking me, what should I study if I want to eventually go into apologetics? And I always say, I think you should study philosophy. I think you should know the history of Western thought. Schaeffer used to really stress, you cannot understand the person sitting next to you if you don't really know the whole history of Western thought and culture, because our ideas have been shaped historically from the ancient Greeks up through today. One thinker influences the next, who influences the next, who influences the next. And so that you really don't understand secular thought unless you see where it came from and how it developed. And even in cultural apologetics, you know, the HBU graduate program here focuses on cultural apologetics. But even then, you have to know the philosophy behind the arts. What philosophical ideas are the artists expressing? Why are they expressing these ideas? Every ism, you know, every art movement, impressionism, expressionism, minimalism, whatever. All the art movements also have been influenced by Western thought and culture. The artists are not just playing around with, you know, they're not just playing with imaginary ideas. The imaginative ideas are always expressing some worldview. So if you, I always think that the best route to ending up with apologetics is to understand intellectual history. If I could go back and study intellectual history, not very many universities offer that. But the closest next thing is history of philosophy. Understanding where ideas came from and why people think the way they do today.
Professor Piercy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast as well. A lot of what we've talked about has come out of Professor Piercy's book, Love Thy Body, and another book that she's published called Total Truth. You can find those at good book retailers that you shop from. And we encourage you to check out some of the other podcasts that are available, podcast episodes that are available through the Wesley Seminary podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.